Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome, everybody, to another day, another show, another Damage Report. I'm Johnny Rolla. We got a big old show for you today. We're going to be starting off with The View. Apologies in advance, but some stuff went down on yesterday's show that I just have to comment on because I think it's pretty important. But throughout the rest of the hour, we've got two guests are going to be joining us. Emma Vigeland is going to be joining us for a couple different topics. One, her recent on-location report of how one of the big Trump donors, one of just the premier chicken plants, has been spraying liquid feces right near people's houses, and they've been getting incredibly sick from it. So she had a report on that. We're also going to be breaking down some of the other big news of the day, including fallout from Joe Biden's segregationist comments from yesterday. Chrissy Teigen picking a fight with Bernie supporters. We'll be debating that. And Bernie Sanders' own tweet appearing to throw some shade at Warren. We'll be talking about that. We've got an update on Yemen. We've got New York passing a really ambitious plan to deal with climate change. A big old show. You're going to want to watch the entire thing, but we'll be starting off with The View and Meghan McCain. Yesterday, after Donald Trump's launch of his campaign that wasn't an actual launch, The View was talking about it. And Meghan McCain, the show's conservative, was providing a defense to some extent of Donald Trump and his supporters. And I want to break down a couple different aspects of this, but first, I'm sorry, I just have to start off with a fact check, because although I think that the bar for how much I expect Meghan McCain to know on a day-to-day basis is not super, super high, there's some stuff that's just so easy to disprove. So here she is.
The arena was completely packed, and I looked it up afterward, and I don't think so.
Yes,
and I
will say, there had buses ready for
it. Well, there, people were lining up 40 hours prior to the event. So
some
he still
people.
Has, yeah. Well, some people, yes, but there were people lining up 40 hours.
There's always
event.
People who would
yeah,
do that.
Go ahead.
What I'm trying
go ahead,
to say.
I don't know if there are people lining up 40 hours before a lot of Democratic candidates.
Not yet.
Okay, so some of what she said there is totally fine, and some is ridiculous. The thing was not fully packed. There were some seats open. Like, that's not a bad thing. To point that out is not, it's not like needling Donald Trump. It's difficult to fill a 20 to 25,000 person arena. But just don't brag that that's what you're doing. Don't brag about the fact that 120,000 people supposedly are going to show up when it turns out that the overflow area is absolutely empty. There's seats inside and people could buy, could get tickets at the last minute and then walk in. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But Trump shouldn't pretend that the opposite is true, and neither should Meghan McCain. On the busing, for instance, she says, no, I don't think that that's true. Super easy to check. New York Times, the Trump campaign rented buses across Florida to bring in supporters. Now, it's a little bit, there's some ambiguity because Trump's campaign lied about it. A campaign spokesman, Tim Murtaugh, said the campaign didn't rent buses other than shuttles for donors from a hotel to the arena. So I'm going to assume that the New York Times had a good source on that. But even if what Tim Murtaugh is saying is true, they did provide buses to bring in supporters. And that too is not that bad of a thing. And I have to imagine that everybody does that. If Obama had a big rally, they probably provided some public transportation for people to get there. That's not the end of the world, but you don't have to react as defensively as even Meghan McCain, who doesn't count herself as a Trump lover, acted when that was brought up, an inconvenient truth right there. And in terms of the people who were waiting, you know, 120 hours or whatever, 140 hours, yes, that's true. But we can't be as uncritical as Meghan McCain was there and some in the media were when 2 days before that rally, there were all these articles in the biggest newspapers in the country that, oh my God, the Trump fervor, there are people lining up days in advance. Yes, there were people lining up days in advance, but not because it's going to sell out or it's not a Beyonce, it's not like trying to get tickets to UConn football. Yes, you could line up, but you don't have to line up. You're choosing to line up. It's like people used to camp out for the iPhone because it sold out. I could have camped out for the Microsoft Zune, but I didn't need to. I probably could have gotten one anyway. So it's a show of enthusiasm that, by the way, no one is doubting that there are huge Trump fans. It's one of the most powerful cults in American political history. Nobody's doubting that, but that does not mean that secretly 60 or 70 or 80% of the country is his, you know, devoted fan. So let's draw the right lessons from these sorts of things, but that's not my expectation for Meghan McCain necessarily. Meghan McCain and talking about Donald Trump's rally. Also, she expressed a little bit of shock at something that she saw. Not, you know, like when Donald Trump was saying that the Democrats literally want to destroy you and the country and all that. She found something much more particular to her, but here is what she said.
It was hard for me to watch Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham in there.
Oh, that
and I know
incredible.
Marco Rubio came out this morning saying it's not unusual for me to be supporting, as a senator, to be supporting the president as well. But he was sort of negging Lindsey Graham at the same time. And I even tweeted last night.
Who was doing
the president
that?
Was.
Against
watch
Lindsey?
The rally. Yes,
wow.
Please. And he was saying, he was sort of it. Saying like his poll numbers were so down and now he's here. And I was like, yes. This is what happens. You have to show up the rally and you have to kiss the ring mm-hmm. and you'll be great politically yeah. in the Republican right. Party. And it was just a weird thing for me to watch.
I bet.
As all of you can probably understand.
Yeah. Lindsey has sold and, his soul.
Yep. It like the transformation's complete. That's yes. what I thought last night.
Yes.
Is that your political transformation is complete.
So, look, admittedly, I don't watch a lot of The View, but when I do, it's for hot takes from 2016, 2 years, 3 years later. Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, they didn't sell their soul 32 hours ago. That was a long, long time ago. Like, Meghan McCain sat through Lindsey Graham in the Brett Kavanaugh hearings and watched that ridiculous defense of Brett Kavanaugh, watched him rush to the defense of Donald Trump. How many times now have we shown that? How many times has Lindsey Graham gone directly against past Lindsey Graham comments? I mean, he said that Donald Trump would be the death of the Republican Party, that he was a whack job, I think was the word he used. You can check that. He sold his soul yesterday. And so I don't know if she's being facetious or what, but like, that's one of the most watched political programs now in the country. For better or for worse, The View is where a lot of people get their news. And for conservatives who get it there, that's their avatar. That's their champion, Meghan McCain. And she's just now getting the fact that Republicans who had previously implied that they were better in some fashion than Donald Trump, whether morally or intellectually or ideologically or whatever, have sold out and have done whatever it takes to get his approval. That's not news in June of 2019. That's years ago. And she's just catching up now. That is not a good sign going forward for the conservative perspective, I guess, on The View. But the most important thing, I think, that came from yesterday's episode of The View has to do with Meghan McCain explaining why some people are devoted to Donald Trump. An explanation, by the way, that on the internet, I've seen her getting a lot of credit for identifying this. I personally don't think it's quite as incisive as necessarily as she thought, but it did lead to a really interesting conflict on the show. And so here it is.
Don't belittle the crowds. Don't belittle the enthusiasm. What? Democrats still have a lot to come because it's a lot of people still enthusiastic. And I was trying to explain because one of my producers this morning was saying, why do people love him so much? And I was like, sometimes it's not just that they love Trump so much. It's that they hate the same things Trump hates. That's what's going
Who,
on.
Black
as
people,
well.
You mean? And immigrants?
No, I mean.
Who do they hate? Who do they
you
hate?
Know what? You know what, Joy? I really
who
come
they
here
hate?
Every day open-minded
right.
just trying to explain it.
Okay.
And it's not a fun job for
but
me every day.
But who do they hate?
I know you're angry. I
you
get it that you're angry that Trump's president, like a lot of people are.
I'm angry about every single thing he's doing.
But I don't think yelling at me is going to fix the problem, okay? I just said that it was hard for me to watch. Yes, I just said it was hard for me to watch Lindsey Graham, who I considered an uncle for a long time, okay?
Yeah, but then you're talking about the Trump supporters.
But I'm trying to explain why 2020 is not in the bag for you.
It's not. Here's the
question. Okay, guys, okay. Okay. It's a great discussion, and we can go back to it. I just need everybody to take a beat.
But being just, a sacrificial Republican every day,
well,
I'm just trying
listen,
to.
Here's the thing.
Oh, don't feel bad for me. I paid to do this, okay? Don't feel bad for me.
Yeah, she dropped a B-bomb, which I guess technically you can do on TV. I think we might be able to do it here. I'm not going to take the chance. So apparently this is something they do commonly, which was offered as a defense with Meghan McCain saying, Joy and I call each other bees all the time. I know this is a big shock. We get along backstage. Maybe not as much as you think. Maybe not as much. And Joy Behar said, we're both pugilistic, and so we're fine. I'm very straight in what I believe, and so is she. So we're going to fight. I don't care if you call me a bee. Okay, so a couple issues in that clip there. Identifying that Trump supporters like him because he hates the same people that they do. One is not as positive a spin on Trump supporters as she presented it as. I see that as kind of a bad thing. And also, by the way, an obvious thing. Who doesn't know that in 2019? But that is the incisive commentary that they're paying her, I have to imagine, many times what I make to provide. That yes, the support for Donald Trump is based on the fact that he has the same sorts of xenophobia and homophobia and Islamophobia and all of that and racism and misogyny that they do. Yes, we all get that at this point. We understand that. And that's one of the reasons why her other point, don't belittle them, is a little bit frustrating for me. And I think probably for a lot of you who have gone through multiple years of this. If you want to say don't belittle them because pragmatically it will be more difficult to win them over if you do that, fine. I think that's a perfectly fine point. Nobody's gonna come over to your side after you've made fun of them. But you can understand how when the things that appear to lead a person, not necessarily to vote Republican or even to vote Trump, but to go to a Trump rally are two things. Hating the same people, the same groups of Americans that he hates, and having no cares whatsoever in this world for whether what you're hearing is true. That's frustrating for a person who cares about these groups of Americans and who damn sure cares about the truth. That is very frustrating. And so pragmatically, I might avoid belittling these people for the probably pointless hope that some of them might see the light and cross over at some point. Although that's becoming even more ridiculous 3 years into this experience. But you can understand the frustration. You can understand why we would have a problem with a significant chunk of the American people caring not at all for reality and certainly not caring for a significant chunk of the rest of the Americans that make up our population. Final point. I really wish, and this is my criticism of Meghan McCain and my lack of understanding for exactly why she's there. When she was like, it's so hard for me to see Lindsey Graham there when I saw him as an uncle. Here is the issue. And when you're no longer a child, when you become an adult, you should be able to differentiate between liking a person because you went to a picnic with them and them being a horrible person. Lindsey Graham is a bad guy in a number of different ways. Foreign policy would be enough if there wasn't everything else. I mentioned his defense of Kavanaugh and all that. He's a bad guy. It doesn't matter if you hung out with him when you were young. The same sort of distinction, by the way, could be made with a direct family member, not someone who's like an uncle, but for instance, a father. You could have a father and you could have great memories of growing up with them, but if they're a vicious warmonger, that's a bad thing. And you should be able to recognize both of those things. Meghan McCain is not 12. She's not 20. She's a full grown woman, an educated woman who has no ability to see past her own familial biases towards these people, to see what they actually represent, what effect they're actually having on American politics. And that same sort of bias, the opinions it leads to, get broadcast to tens of millions of people every single week. Okay, we are gonna take a break now. When we come back, Emma Vigeland's gonna be joining us from Rebel HQ. She's done some awesome in the field reporting and she'll give you all the details after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
No fishing, no swimming, don't eat crabs, and don't swim. Why? Because it's all cancer.
That's the voice of a resident of a community whose health has been devastated by a toxic combination of corporate greed and political corruption, coming from a recent report on Rebel HQ by Emma Vigeland, who joins us now on the Damage Report. Emma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Glad to have you here. So you released this video recently profiling this big Trump supporting company. What did you find?
Well, yeah, I mean, so this company was Donald Trump's fifth largest campaign contributor in 2016, which really, it's not a ton when it compares to Renaissance Technologies, which was clearly his number one, but it was over $2 million. And it's a large chicken farm where they have, they're headquartered in Delaware, and they have a large chicken processing plant in this rural community that is not as wealthy as a lot of the other towns in the area. So, for example, Blades had a similar issue. It's a town 20 miles away, wealthier, their water was contaminated, and they literally called in the Delaware National Guard. And for the poorer community and for a family that I spoke to, the residents were African American, and they've had this property in their family for over 100 years. So, you know, three different houses on this plot. Their great-grandfather was a sharecropper, and he wanted to hold on to this land for them. With the chicken processing plant right across the way, they got no relief. Mysteriously, bottled waters just showed up being dropped off biweekly at their houses. But the root of the problem is still there, which is that this chicken processing plant is spraying waste haphazardly into the air, onto the soil, and they get their water through well water. So they thought it was safe, right? Well water is typically a really safe way to get your water to have the toxins be kind of drawn out. But so much waste was being sprayed into the air that the nitrates seeped through the wells. And this family was drinking this toxic water, as were many in the community, for they don't even know how long. And this one family has experienced the death of a 24-year-old, multiple amputations, a daughter born with a third ear. And basically, there's been no justice. And there are hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits now that are currently being levied against this company. But the Democratic senators, Carper and Coons from Delaware, have been largely silent. So it's a story, once again, of environmental racism and just socioeconomic discrimination for people who are experiencing this kind of trauma due to acute poisoning in their water.
So for everyone watching this, the full report that Emma did is up on the YouTube channel of Rebel HQ, and you interviewed a bunch of people, and it's both fascinating and also incredibly dark. Some of it very difficult to listen to. You can see people breaking up during the interviews. You did a great job with that. Just very briefly, you talked about the two Democratic senators. Are they also receiving money from Mountow Farms? Do we know that?
We don't know for sure. I've been in kind of a whirlwind with this report, and I was more focusing just on how the reach of this company has gone all the way up to the Trump administration. But especially the local officials, they have not been responsive to the people in the area.
Wow. And so, I mean, this really combines so many of our different concerns here at TYT, the environmental damage these areas being destroyed, people's health being destroyed, and necessarily all in the pursuit of a little bit more money for a company that apparently has $2 million laying around that they can donate to one presidential campaign during one campaign. I mean, just insane. And so anybody watching this, I definitely think you should go watch the full report where Emma breaks down all the details. Emma, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, a lot of different topics in the news today to break down with you. So we'll see you on the other side. And now more with Emma Vigeland on the big news of the day, starting with Joe Biden. So I'm sure you're aware yesterday Joe Biden made a couple of comments about how back in the day he had a great civil relationship with a couple of different segregationists, saying, I was in a caucus with James O. Eastland. He never called me boy. He always called me son. At least there was some civility. We got things done. And so some people didn't like that. They thought, maybe don't talk about the great relationship you had with some of the most violent racists. I mean, if you look at some of the things Eastland has said, it is insane. So what did you think about this?
Civility. What a dumb word. Why would you want to be civil with someone who is supportive of segregationist policies, a segregationist champion, an open racist, unless you also were supportive of segregationist policies yourself, like Joe Biden was? When he entered the Senate in the early 70s, he was more pro-integration than he eventually became, because the white working class in Delaware basically pressured him against it. And then he was a crusader against integration policies in the North. He thought it was applicable for the South, but that the North should be exempt from those things, which was code speak for Northern racist rhetoric back in the day. And so what bothers me when we're talking about this conversation in the press is, like, Biden wasn't just complimentary of these segregationist senators. He was a promoter of segregationist policies himself. Mm-hmm. And that's where we should be starting this conversation. That the Democratic frontrunner right now, someone who's polling very well with Black Americans, especially older Black Americans, is someone who was supportive of segregation at the outset of his career as a legislator. And so we have to have a reckoning. We have to have a conversation about why that is, and why maybe name recognition, why just kind of his tangential association with Obama is winning out over his very disastrous rhetoric at the current moment. My belief is that that will change. But his, again, you know, I tweeted this last night because I just couldn't stand it anymore. His record's like 10 times worse than Hillary Clinton's was. Everything under the sun that you can find about Joe Biden supporting things that, you know, have aged incredibly poorly, you can find. And so I think that this is going to be the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Biden's record. And when we're talking about his record in relation to race, this isn't even touching on the 1994 crime bill.
Yeah. And we talked earlier this year about his comments on busing. That's not going to go away. That will come back. And so you're talking there about the record, which is true. He's got a lot of big issues in his record that he can't really avoid and refuses to apologize for. But also you have the campaigning. Like we've been saying, this guy doesn't campaign well. There's a reason he lost the last couple of times he ran for president. It's because it's bad enough, the comments about busing, you know, decades ago. But he has to double down. He has to tie himself to those same people again. And so I talked about apologizing. There was a negative response from pretty much all the other candidates to what he had said. Cory Booker specifically said that he should apologize. And Joe Biden decided to do something different. He said this: they know better. Apologize for what? Cory should apologize. He knows better. There's not a racist bone in my body. I've been involved in civil rights my whole career. Period, period, period. So when asked by Cory Booker to apologize, he says that no, it's Cory Booker that has the problem.
Yeah, I mean, wow. So first of all, this is Cory Booker's greatest day of his life that he's finally being talked about in the presidential race. So congratulations, Cory. And secondly, Joe Biden is, his arrogance is, I think, been, I underestimated it even going into this campaign. It's Trumpian. He just goes on the offensive whenever he is attacked about his record or rightfully asked about it, because it's seriously problematic. So that's really what bothers me about this. I mean, he only apologized about his inappropriate behavior towards women too when he was essentially forced to. His instinct and his first instinct and his 26th instinct is to double down. And only when he's pressured those 26 times does he get to the actually apologizing. And it reminds me of Trump. It really does.
And I will, at some point, I'll stop adding this caveat as we get farther in the primary, but I want to make sure that people understand it, because we did a couple of videos that were critical of Joe Biden yesterday. And one of the comments was, if Biden becomes the candidate, John's going to end up supporting him. He'll have to eat crow. No, you eat crow when you were wrong and then you had a change. I've been incredibly consistent. He's worse than a lot of the other primary candidates and far better than Donald Trump. That is a consistent position, the only rational position. And so while I am not supporting him in the primary, yes, obviously if he's the nominee, I would support him. So let's just get that on the record long in advance of the actual election. Let's turn now to the next topic. Yesterday, Bernie Sanders had a tweet in response to, I think it was a Politico piece about the third way and how some of these big centrist organizations have sort of warmed to Elizabeth Warren. And his tweet was, the cat is out of the bag. The corporate wing of the Democratic Party is publicly, quote, anybody but Bernie. They know our progressive agenda of Medicare for all, breaking up big banks, taking on drug companies, and raising wages is the real threat to the billionaire class. Many people took this as being critical of Elizabeth Warren, especially because that headline specifically references Elizabeth Warren. A lot of people did not like this tweet. What was your reaction?
Yeah, so I'm mixed on it, right? I like both candidates, so I really don't like seeing Bernie Sanders go after Elizabeth Warren. It just is a bummer to me because I think they're on the right side of 90% of issues and agree on most things, but he has to do something. He's not really gaining a ton of traction in the polls while she's skyrocketing ahead, and there are clear differences. The fact that Third Way is more open to her than to him is an indicator of the fact that she isn't as barn-burning progressive as he is. And I'm not even saying that in a derogatory way in any way. I'm obviously a huge supporter of Bernie Sanders. But her not emphasizing Medicare for all is an indicator that she's probably not going to fight for it as hard as Bernie would. And his labeling of himself as a democratic socialist, I think, really freaks Third Way out, whereas Elizabeth Warren has said that she's a capitalist. And I think that both of those things, it's overblown how they decide to label themselves. But Warren is a less, I would say, worker-focused candidate, whereas Bernie is just with unions, going into the Walmart executives' offices or into their board meetings and giving speeches. He's a populist to his core, while Elizabeth Warren is a progressive politician. And I think that that's the distinction. And so it bummed me out. I do think that he was trying to take a small shot, but he's also just trying to distinguish himself, which I think is totally legitimate and fine. So there are two very good candidates in this race, in my view. Bernie Sanders, though, I think hits everything out of the park in terms of policy.
I mostly agree with what you said there. I would say that when looking at a number of the proposals that she's come out with this year, I think that she is very much a populist. I just think that she's less of a specifically union affiliated populist, less of a I'm going to walk the strike lines populist. She's more of an academic like populist as opposed to a, like a foot soldier populist, I guess. But
yeah, and I'm perplexed by Third Way's saying that they're open to her. I mean, but that's also like Third Way would support any of the other candidates with the exception of maybe Tulsi Gabbard or Mike Gravel or someone like that, right? But now they're kind of open to Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
So I think that saying that Third Way is like really behind her is super misleading.
Exactly. And I don't take the tweet exactly the same as some other people, but I would have worded it differently. Like some people will take from that he's saying that in some way you can link her to the corporate, you know, wing of the party, which obviously I don't think is what he means, and it's not fair. He has to defend himself. As you point out, he's going down in the polls, she's going up. He can't simply like fade into the darkness. She takes all of his, drinks his milkshake. But I think that you don't want to throw gas on the fire of the people who are like they like the idea of attacking Elizabeth Warren now, and so they're trying to imply that she's some sort of like shadow neoliberal or something like that. And so
I keep saying she's going to take us to war with Iran.
Yeah,
her military budget record isn't that great, but that is an absurd claim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to Bernie Sanders, I would just word it a little bit better in the future. Let's turn now to a related topic, actually, that might have come out of that. Chrissy Teigen was tweeting about politics yesterday, including about Bernie Sanders. And she responded to a reply she'd gotten from a Bernie supporter by saying, "Bernie supporters will be the downfall of Bernie. I don't even hate him, but you guys are absolutely insufferable. Do him a favor and stop being so combative against Democratic criticism." So look, she, and by the way, you can read, there's many, many replies where she goes back and forth with a number of different people. And I will say specifically in that conversation, the replies to her were not diplomatic. I mean, I wouldn't want that sort of activity in my Twitter feed. I think that she has been pretty anti-Bernie in the past. So I don't think that that's necessarily a fair way she characterized herself at the beginning. But what do you think about the criticism that Bernie supporters in particular are too aggressive on Twitter to people who disagree with them?
People are too aggressive on Twitter in general. So I'm not even going to go after Bernie supporters specifically. But like, look, I mean, I've been getting into arguments with people, but I think they're more, you know, Tulsi Gabbard supporters about how I think Elizabeth Warren is the second most progressive candidate in the race. that's fine. People are very aggressive towards me, but I'm in the realm of politics. Chrissy Teigen doesn't know anything. She's a rich person who doesn't love Bernie Sanders. Join the club of rich people, which probably has wonderful shrimp cocktails. And I'm sure they make them out of her cookbook, which every white girl in America has bought.
I also bought it.
Oh, you did? Well,
I
shame
bought
on
a
you.
Little bit of her cookware recently, actually. It's pretty good. Her recipes are great, okay? Have you made her potato smashies? They're a delight.
Chrissy Teigen shill. You're a Teigen corporate shill.
That's true.
I'm starting the hashtag.
Okay. Sorry for that diversion.
But yeah, no, I mean, she's a rich person that doesn't like Bernie Sanders. Join the club. And I think her arguments against him are largely weak. What I found interesting was she was replying to his tweet that we referenced earlier that was kind of going a little after Elizabeth Warren and defending her. I'm so annoyed by like these people who just kind of dabble in politics now being like, oh, Elizabeth Warren's my candidate and versus Bernie. Like they don't really understand, I think, the similarities in policy and how defending Hillary Clinton in 2016 is super different from defending Elizabeth Warren in 2020, because they are extremely different people with very different priorities. And just because she's a woman, now we're seeing this sort of neoliberal coalition around her, not even from like actual people in the establishment, but from just casual viewers on Twitter like Chrissy Teigen. And it just is a little bit of a pet peeve, because when we're talking about policy, the only candidate that's more different than Hillary Clinton is Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm a little bit torn in it. I think, look, yes, she's a rich celebrity, but I think that she knows as much as the vast majority of people on Twitter do about politics. And she's certainly free to express herself, even if on this I disagree with her. I've been a Bernie Sanders supporter for a very long time, longer than we were talking about him before anyone thought it was a serious candidacy back in 2015. And so I delight in being attacked by people who've been a Bernie supporter for far less time. But I'm not going to pretend that there aren't Bernie supporters on Twitter who are absolute awful toxic trolls. There are. It's Twitter. It's where trolls go to live. It's where you go for trolls.
Yeah. And I will say that there's some candidates that have a cult of personality around them. Trump is the most infamous one. Yeah. I would say Tulsi Gabbard is another one. But Bernie has some too. And just because I agree with him on almost everything, and he's, you know, one of the two candidates I'm probably going to vote for. That's what I've narrowed it down to as of right now, probably him. That doesn't mean that I can't acknowledge that some of the supporters go a little too far.
And while at the same time acknowledging that I've seen like the people who, I guess there are people who agree with like Neera Tanden on stuff. They're not nice on Twitter. Like
yeah,
they're aggressive too. And I saw comments responding to some of this saying like, when I would make the point that like, some groups are a little bit more aggressive, or maybe that a lot of people are aggressive, they'd be like, well, Julian Castro supporters on Twitter aren't that toxic. And it's like, I guess I haven't seen much from them, honestly, from a lot of these candidacies that don't have that much support necessarily.
Supporters make a great pecan pie.
Mm-hmm. I would say in general, and I tweeted to this effect this morning, most people on Twitter are far too sure of themselves, far too hostile towards people that disagree with them. I am like that sometimes too, and I feel like when it's tweeting at someone in like right-wing media or something, it's justified, but we do have to try to be a little bit more understanding, I think.
That's a great message, John. Thank you. I'm trying. Kumbaya.
I'm trying. And by the way, however bad you think that any particular group are, whether it's Bernie Sanders supporters or not, there are Twitter like contrarians who, like some of whom profess that they like Bernie Sanders. I personally think that they worship at the altar of nihilism, that are far worse. So let's understand the severity of the things we're dealing with. I wish we had more time, because I want to talk to you about the Iran drone situation, the escalation there. That's all the time we have though. Emma Vigeland, as always, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks so much, John.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, a little update on what's going on with the war in Yemen after this. After a monumental, nearly year-long effort to end US involvement in the conflict in Yemen, we had progress in both the House and the Senate. Eventually, we had votes to pull us out of that conflict, drawing a presidential veto, unfortunately. But that does not mean that the effort stops there. And joining us now to break down update on getting us out of that conflict is co-director of Just Foreign Policy, Hassan Al-Tayeb. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So it's been a little bit since we last spoke, something like a month or so. And so has there been any movement in the right direction on once again pushing for some limit on how we're getting involved in that Saudi-led conflict on Yemen?
Yes, there actually has. In this past week, during consideration of the national defense budget, the House just voted to end arms sales to Saudi, or to go back to the before the emergency declaration that we were that Trump declared to push through $8.1 billion of weapons sales through. And that got there was an amendment that got attached to the defense appropriations bill. And so that was introduced by Representative Ted Lieu. On the Senate side, actually today there's some news as well. They just voted and passed with a 53-vote majority to block the 22 arms sales as well. It's unclear whether or not we have enough votes at this point to block the veto override, you know, to do a veto override if that should happen. Trump has threatened to do that, but there's some promising signs that Congress isn't going to just let their ability to, you know, have oversight over the Arms Export Control Act.
So I believe that you implied there that he will veto that block, which I think is 100% true. Yeah. And in terms of the votes to override that veto, I really wonder if it's really a question of this particular vote, or really considering the personality characteristics of Donald Trump, whether Republican senators would ever override one of his vetoes. I have to imagine that that would lead to him opposing them in their next election. There probably has to be quite a bit of fear, I assume.
For sure, I think that there is, you know, no one wants to get a tweet with their name on it from Donald Trump, that's for sure. But I wanted to stress that they have, if they stand united, they have a real chance to do this, because the defense budget is a must-pass bill. It's typically not vetoed. The president, you know, signs it because it's this large spending package, and it's hard to go after individual line items. So Congress really does have the power of the purse here. So I think if they stand united, they can block these arms sales. And also embedded in that, I didn't mention, but embedded in the House version of the defense appropriations bill, there's other language in there to block logistical support. So we wouldn't just be stopping the arms sales. We could stop the mid-air refueling and the logistical support, in addition to training of Saudi Air Force and UAE Air Forces.
Okay, that's actually very interesting. I'm glad that you added that, because my fear was that they would find some way to move around the money. But if it has specific prohibitions against those sorts of things, that would be progress. Although I believe that they claim that the mid-air refueling ended months ago. Isn't that the official line from the Pentagon?
Yeah, so in November, they officially, you know, they let Congress know that they would stop the mid-air refueling. As far as we know, that you know, cessation of the mid-air refueling has stopped. But to get it definitively, you know, in writing, in law, I think that would be another critical step.
You know, I'm also curious, while we're dealing with the situation in Yemen and have been for some time, every day it seems like there's another attempt to escalate the situation with Iran. How does that complicate efforts in the House or the Senate to do something about Yemen?
I think it actually increases the urgency to restrain Saudi Arabia and, you know, to kind of put up, you know, some protection so we're not going to be waging unconstitutional war. I will say that there's also legislation that was introduced by Senator Udall and Representative Eshoo that's being attached to the National Defense Authorization Act that would also prevent funds going to an unauthorized war with Iran. So there are some connections. You know, a lot of times you hear the opposition say that, well, the Houthis are, you know, Shia, and therefore they're connected to Iran. While there are some connections, it's very limited. So there's a lot of, you know, talk about, you know, connecting the Houthis to Iran. I think what's really interesting, though, that not enough people are talking about, is that they're saying under the 2001 AUMF that they have authority to go after Iran because Iran is somehow tied to al-Qaeda, which is absolutely preposterous. You know, Iran, they're Shia, and al-Qaeda is Sunni. You know who is Sunni, though, is Saudi Arabia, and they have been working with Al-Qaeda hand in hand in Yemen in their anti-Houthi army on the ground. So I think it's preposterous to blame Iran for working with Al-Qaeda when Saudi Arabia is working with Al-Qaeda and funding them every day.
I literally could not agree more. And thank you, as always, for joining us. Very important updates there. And we appreciate you keeping us appraised on the situation.
Hey, thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break here. We come back one more block. We're going to break down some pretty good progress in New York on dealing with climate breakdown after this. Although the election of Donald Trump as president was clearly the death of any federal effort over these past few years to stop climate breakdown internationally, we have been able to rely recently on states to do something significant and substantive about emissions and our climate crisis. In just the last year, Maine, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, New Mexico, California, and New Jersey passed a pretty ambitious targets for renewable energy and lowering statewide emissions. Actually, since 2015, Hawaii has had a 100% renewables target in place. Well, we've got one more state to add to that list with perhaps a better plan than all but maybe Hawaii, and that is New York with their new plan. New York's new climate targets include 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040 and economy-wide net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The difference there between zero and net zero is that only 85% of the reductions must come from New York's own energy and industrial emissions. The remaining 15% can come from carbon offsets, like from forestry or agriculture, or I guess at least hypothetically carbon capture and sequestration in the future, although that's a little bit far off. So look, the whole zero versus net zero thing, that's not the best. We would prefer the former, but I understand where they're coming from. And understand that when we talk about state level efforts, the state does not have legal authority to control everything that can conceivably emit carbon or other sorts of pollutants. They can control what they can, but for the rest, offsets can be useful. And in terms of those offsets, it sounds like that might open up for some, like if corporate lobbyists to give a little bit of extra leeway to coal plants or something like that, so they can continue polluting, but with offsets, which is not the goal that we as environmental progressives are going for. But this plan is actually pretty savvy when it comes to things like that. Stationary electrical sources like power plants cannot avail themselves of offsets. It's there basically for things like, I think they said cement mixing is one example, and others where hypothetically there will be a need for offsets in the short term, and they're not polluters to the scale or magnitude that something like a coal plant would be. In terms of verifying that this goes the way it should and that corporations are not finding tricky ways to get around the requirements in the bill, emission reductions must be real and verifiable. They must be distributed equitably. So that's where you get into the component of environmental justice. They must not increase emissions of co-pollutants, and they must minimize so-called leakage, whereby emitting facilities simply relocate outside of the state. That last bit sounds difficult in the long term to make sure of, but they are setting up a council that's going to be checking in periodically to make sure that corporations aren't evading either the letter or hopefully the spirit of the law as well. Every 4 years, the council will issue a comprehensive report on state greenhouse gas emissions and progress and adjust its plan as needed. So look, this is not the best plan that you could conceivably come up with, but it is pretty amazing. It's better than many of the other states that have actually come up with plans to deal with climate change have done. This is, I think, a good model for other parts of the country going forward. If we could get every state to require at least something approaching this, that would go a long way towards fulfilling our requirements under the Paris Climate Accord, which of course we're not a part of, but ideally we would still abide by its goals. This, I think, is a great week of progress for people who care about dealing with the climate crisis. At the same time, though, I'm not going to pretend that the situation is great. Progress is great, but we have to be realistic. This is the damage report after all. And so I just did a little bit of just brief searching, like type in climate, type in, you know, emissions and things like that, and you'll see what comes up. And in just the past couple of days, news broke that Himalayan glacier melting has doubled since 2000, according to spy satellites. So that's bad, not just as a signal that the climate is warming, but for the 1 billion people who depend on those glaciers for water, that's potentially a life or death crisis right there. In terms of our ability to do something about climate change, if it continues, like rising ocean levels and things like that, if we want to ward off the damage, Seawalls to protect the U.S. against rising oceans could cost $416 billion over just the next couple of decades. So if you think we're just going to build some walls, how are we going to pay for it? I hope Jake Tapper asked that. And to return to sort of the beginning of this segment, we're talking about federal efforts to do something about climate breakdown. Trump has now ditched the sole climate rule that aimed to reduce coal plant pollution, getting rid of the Clean Power Plan for his new plan, which pretends that it cares about emissions, in particular of carbon, but is incredibly friendly to dirty sources of energy. So that is the reality of what we're dealing with now, but on the state level, and especially in New York, which, by the way, we only got this because of progressive state level primary challenges this last time around. Up until then, the IDC had been blocking exactly this sort of plan. That is progress, and we can duplicate that in other states if we take these primaries seriously going forward. Okay, thank you for watching the entirety of this show. It was great to have Em on. We've got Brett is going to be joining us tomorrow. One more day of news to get through. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.